Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Big Blend Radio's fourth Wednesday Tucson Sisters in Crime show. Tucson Sisters in Crime, it's a local Tucson, Arizona chapter of the international organization known as Sisters in Crime, which is made up of authors, writers, readers, librarians, publishers, agents, editors, booksellers, everybody who has a passion for the mystery genre. And they welcome sisters and brothers in crime. So dudes, you can get involved too. If you're interested in writing and also in Southern Arizona and its mystery community. So I encourage you to go to the website. It's TucsonSistersInCrime.org. We've been having so much fun interviewing the authors from this organization. And today we're excited because we've got another awesome, this is going to be such a fascinating conversation. It's very timely. Mm-hmm. We have Dr. Melissa Edson joining us now. I'm going to change her name now that she's coming on, and I had it right earlier. But she's joining us. She is the author. It's an alphabetical microbial mystery series that she writes. So she's going in the alphabet. And
who does that?
Yeah. And she really does know about microbial issues and, even the COVID pandemic. She is really quite fascinating. I encourage you to go to her website and it follows her series. It's drmayamaguire.com. That's DrMayamaguire, drmayamaguire.com. She's also on Twitter to keep up with her and get involved with what she's writing about. And she's not zooming in from Tucson. Today, she's zooming in from Vermont, where she lives, but she does write about the region. So as I was saying, the organization does welcome folks from around the country, around the world, who are interested in the Southwest region, which she does write about. So welcome, Millie. How are you?
I'm great. It's wonderful that we all have our Arizona backgrounds, and it makes me feel, I grew up in Tucson, so it makes me so homesick to see all the photos. So
yeah, it makes us a little homesick too. We haven't been home to Tucson. Our storage unit is there as we travel full time, and Eva Eldridge is there. Our good friend Eva got us all connected with the Tucson Sisters and Michael and Mark. We got a lot of friends out there, and whenever we look at this or cover Tucson Sisters
and Rondi, now that we started the list,
now we're going to get in trouble.
Can't leave it.
We're in trouble now. But we do get homesick, and there's it's a magical area, and with five seasons.
You know, Edward Abbey, famous Southwestern author and also activist, said that whatever area that you grow up in kind of bonds you to it in regards to your definition of beauty and, you know, what fills your soul. And so I definitely feel that way about the Southwest and Southern Arizona, because that's where I grew up. And it's still, even though I've retired to Vermont, the Southwest is still kind of my ideal of a beautiful area.
It is. It is. That's interesting what you say about Edward Abbey, because part of the reason we moved to Tucson is that it reminds us, especially going south Tucson, like Green Valley down to Macacri and Rio Rico, that area reminds us of Kenya and South Africa, where we lived for many years. And as a kid, I grew up in Kenya, and it's just, I was like, oh, I'm home. But we do miss it. We haven't been to Vermont yet, but you do travel back to Tucson, right?
Right. We still have family both in Tucson and Phoenix area, so we get back as often as we can. And unfortunately, during the pandemic, we haven't been back, but we do try to get back there.
So your background is fascinating. You're into all these crazy, weird diseases and epidemics that are going on, and understand all that science and biology, and you know what goes on in a Petri dish, basically. And it's really fascinating because you're doing the alphabetical series. And are you working on the COVID one now while it's happening?
I'm certainly kind of taking notes. I'll actually start. There's a wonderful national initiative called NaNoWriMo. I don't know if you've heard of it, but the National November Writing Month. And that's what I used last November to write my second book, Borrelia. And I'm actually going to start writing the third book about coronavirus this November.
Wow.
So do you have a theory of how it got here?
Well, that's interesting, and I'll certainly delve into that in my book, because the coronavirus one, although the characters will be affected like all of us by coronavirus, the novel will mainly focus on the connection with animals, because that's what most people don't know about, and that's the whole theme of the book series, are the diseases that we can get from animals, which are called zoonoses. You know, the word zoo is in it. And so the coronavirus one will focus on the connection to animals. And my main character for the novel series is Maya McGuire, Dr. Maya McGuire, who's a veterinarian who went into public health like I did, starting out with the Centers for Disease Control. And so she will definitely, although as I said, I haven't started planning the coronavirus one yet, she will definitely be over in China trying to figure that out, whether, you know, how things got started and, you know, which animals, certainly bats are known to carry it, but, you know, whether there was an intervening animal or what. So
wow, that's interesting too, because your first book, or Maya is, and your character, and also your daughter is half Chinese, right? So adopted,
right?
So that touches on even being an immigrant, but then her going to China, that's going to be like an interesting part of it. Like, okay, here I am, you know, part of your culture.
My main protagonist in the book, Maya McGuire, is Chinese American, adopted by her Irish American parents when she was an infant from China, part of the girls that were discarded when China was having its one child policy, and so girls weren't as valued, and that's our own personal experience. We adopted our daughter, Leanne, when she was 4 months old. And so my protagonist is 25 years old in the first book, Anthracis, and it will follow her through about 15 years of her life by the time we get to the Z book, which will be Zika virus.
And, the Zika.
Do you have a virus for every letter?
I do.
You do?
Yep.
Oh, that's scary.
That's so scary. No way.
So I just got to make sure that the original concept was to write a new one every 6 months, and then it would take me about 13 years to finish the series. But the first two have taken longer. I'm heavily involved with, they don't take too long to write, typically about a month or 6 weeks for me to write the very first draft.
Oh, wow.
But then I spend a lot of time workshopping, both with the Sisters in Crime has a great workshop, and then locally we have a Burlington, Vermont writers workshop. And so I spend a lot of time getting feedback on the chapters and editing. So that process has taken a long time. I've actually been editing Anthracis for 2 years since I wrote it, and it's just about ready to be released, to be published.
Oh, wow. So this is the very Anthracis. Okay, so what is Anthracis? I mean, why do they make the names like, you know, it's
just have to be anthrax, right?
I know. It's just, the novels are named after each organism or microbe that is going to be the backbone or the skeleton of the mystery. And so Bacillus anthracis is the Latin name for the anthrax organism. And so I just think anthracis is just such a beautiful kind of spooky name. So I think it's, you know, naming it after the organism instead of the disease was the decision that I made, because the organism is kind of like the bad guy in each book.
So didn't they used to call anthrax hoof and mouth disease?
There's all kinds of lay terms for it. Wool sorters disease, because the bacteria can get in the wool. There's a lot of lay terms for it.
I think my parents used to call it hoof and mouth disease.
There's a different organism that's hoof and mouth. So
is it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, dude. You're freaking me out.
Anthracis, when do you expect it to be out for people to get?
Pretty soon. I think maybe by the time that this airs, it should be out. So I just finished reading the final proofs again last night. And should be getting available on Amazon. And I'm an advocate of what we call wide, publishing wide. So in addition to Amazon, it'll be in, available through other routes.
Awesome. So, awesome. Yeah, because I think we need to have that diversity. We need book diversity and publishing diversity big time. Yeah. And also for booksellers, there's, you know, the monopoly that I'm not going to go crazy on it, but Amazon has been great. And at the same time, and at the same time, we do need to look at the smaller publishing routes and also the independent and independent bookstores. And I think things like the Tucson Festival of Books, is just, it's things like that that are really important for authors to be able to connect with their regular fans, but also to connect with new fans, potential new fans, but also for, you know, folks to get out there and see books in a different way, because I think we're so online now that we've forgotten what it's like to even hold a book. It's like, how do you turn a page?
It's an exciting time for publishing now because there are so many choices and options. And it makes it more complicated in regards to juggling all of them in regards to publication. But Ingram Sparks is what we use to reach libraries and bookstores. And there's Kobo and there's Barnes & Noble has their own site. And then, of course, in addition to the paperbacks, we've got ebooks now and audiobooks. I'm really looking forward to doing an audiobook for Anthrace.
That's awesome. Audiobooks from what we've done.
Those are cool.
Really on the rise, like incredibly on the rise. And I think it's, you know, like podcasting, I mean, we've been doing this almost 15 years and, you know, gone through that whole, like, what's that to, okay, everybody's doing it and everyone can listen anytime with anything, anywhere. I mean, it was at the beginning, you'd have to download a file onto an MP3 player. Now you can just listen in your car through Wi-Fi. So it's, you know, it's really, that's the same for audiobooks. If people can listen while they're doing things. And so it's a bigger market. I think it doubles your market. I really do. You know, so and am I right that your husband produces audiobooks?
Well, he's been a documentarian, so he's done a number of documentary films, actually, about Antarctica, where he used to work. So
no way!
So he's got those technical skills. So yeah, we've already started experimenting with recording some of my short stories. We haven't released any of the audio recordings yet, although the short stories, the publication of the short stories, are available on my website. Most of them for free. Luckily, the magazines and journals that I've published on give you free links to most of them. But yeah, so we've already started experimenting and he has the skill to edit and do all those things that you need to do for the audio recording. So.
Wow. So he's out in Antarctica. Cool. That is amazing. We've done a lot on Antarctica in regards to authors, artists, musicians going there on some big ship. I can't remember the name, and they go out there and it's like an artist in residence program. And, you know, this, I know one lady went diving down in the water. I'm like, what are you nuts? And she's like,
the guy was recording the sound of the ice.
That sound of the ice melting.
Yeah, and then and things like that.
One artist I know was doing texture. She does textile art and doing the rhythms of what you see. She was saying that when you're on the ship, you could see the water and the sound waves and all the different, whatever they were, those thingies that go up and down.
It looks like a beautiful place. I've never been there myself, but I've seen his films and he's been there multiple times. So,
Okay. So speaking of Antarctica, now I'm into this. Okay. So, because, you know, we had Susan Cummin Miller's, you know, is the August interview before you. And we were talking with her because she's a geologist. She's, you know, also part of the Sisters in Crime in Tucson. I wish we had you both on the same show. I think we'd all be like, oh, we're doomed forever. But I was interested in this whole thing in regards, because she's in geology and topography and just fascinating. But what happens as climate change happens and glaciers are melting and the temperatures go up? Is it possible that we're going to have more of these pandemics because organisms are going to wake up and go, oh, I'm here now because you warmed me up. I'm ready. You push the start button on the microwave and here I am. Is that going to happen, do you think?
Well, yes. And my last job before retirement with the New York State Department of Health was helping to coordinate the grant that we had from the Centers for Disease Control to study climate change and health. So climate change and its impact on health has been a big part of my career, and it will be a theme as appropriate throughout these novels. So in Anthracis, it definitely features a lot. The book starts with some human cases of anthrax in Arizona that in reality has never had human cases of anthrax. There are cases every year in Texas among livestock, but Arizona's never had any cases. And so in Anthracis, Arizona all of a sudden starts having human cases. And the theory is that Arizona's having cases because of climate change, because of the background. Oh. Basically, when there's more storms, it can bring the spores. So anthrax bacteria can stay living in the soil for hundreds of years. And the storms can wash the spores up to the surface. And so they're more available for animals or for people to inhale or ingest.
I don't like the word spore. I do not like it. The spore thing freaks me out.
That's pure sci-fi.
It's
triffids. It's the triffids.
Good word for a mystery.
I know. I look at them as like worms that have like a hookworm that like a spore comes to life and it's just going to hook into you. That's gross.
But ew.
I have little segments that Anthracis is interesting because there's three kinds of chapters. Every section of the book is separated by a very short little chapter, just less than one page, that's kind of from the organisms or the spores' point of view. So it's very creepy. It's very creepy.
Oh, that is creepy. Do they have meetings and get together? And
ew. sci-fi, but real.
Yeah, the other spooky thing about Anthracis is that the chapters throughout the book alternate with Maya McGuire's journey as a new veterinary epidemiologist hired by the CDC, and her 2-year training assignment is with the New Mexico Health Department in Santa Fe, then when this anthrax starts occurring in Arizona, they don't have their own EIS officer to be the frontline troops for this. And so Maya goes to Arizona to investigate the anthrax in Arizona. So alternating chapters are her journey, both as a very young, only 25 years old, veterinary epidemiologist starting out, and how she copes with the challenges of this very scary outbreak of anthrax. And it alternates with chapters that are diary chapters starting out 20 years earlier from a young boy. And those diary chapters are pretty spooky. And so throughout the book, you're going forward in the diary chapters of the young boy, and you're also in real time with Maya and her colleagues trying to solve anthrax. And of course, eventually those two themes interrelate, and you're left wondering through much of the book, how does this boy relate to Maya and the anthrax? So.
Oh, wow. Oh, man. When you're writing, wow. I feel like your brain is going in three directions and you manage you're like the traffic controller of spores.
It was definitely complicated plotting this book. I have all these Excel spreadsheets with every day of the year plotted out and who's doing what. And it's pretty complicated to keep a track.
Oh, wow. This is amazing. Wow. Okay. So
that's
I was reading on your
scientific.
Website on how one of the guys, I think it was Dave in the novel, connects this back to the Texas Triangle of Death. What the heck?
Right. So the Texas Triangle of Death is a real thing. I mean, it's been really fun in this novel to use real elements of the diseases as they really occur and can threaten. And then, of course, the fiction part, too, of what if anthrax came to Arizona, since it's never done that before. And we talk about the novels about the three musketeers or three colleagues, Maya, the young veterinary epidemiologist. Then she works very closely with Dave, who is another veterinarian who works for the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And he's based in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he's responsible for animal diseases like in livestock for the region. And so he's a cowboy. He grew up in the part of Texas that has the greatest amount of anthrax naturally in the country right now. And it's called the Texas Triangle Death because of the amount of anthrax that it has every single year in the primarily cattle, sometimes the deer. And then the third person of the three musketeers is Manolo Miranda, who's an infectious disease physician working for the Indian Health Service, and he's based in Phoenix. And he and Maya meet at the very first human case of anthrax. So the three of them together are kind of like a team with a few other characters trying to figure out what's going on and control the anthrax.
So where is the area in Texas that has the triangle of death?
Uvalde is the town, is one of the towns that's in that area. So it's kind of southwest Texas.
Okay. I just don't want to get out of the car.
Yeah.
Because we go trusting
around. Drive on through.
I know, but now, okay, so you're saying that it can happen in deer. And so you were talking about cattle. So back to, like, there's the hoof and mouth, Nancy. But can someone get it from eating meat from the, you know, cattle meat? And then if they hunt a deer and the deer has it, can they get anthrax?
That's the concern. It hasn't been happening in the United States. So it's not easy to get. As the characters talk about, the easiest way to get it is to be like livestock, eating grass from the soil, and then you're exposed to the organism directly. So humans, we don't have our faces down in the soil. So we're not, getting that mouth exposure usually. But one of the fascinating things about anthracis is that I do show you all the different ways that you could get anthrax, even though they're not occurring in this country right now. So it's fascinating just looking worldwide, all the different ways. For instance, there have been big outbreaks overseas from drugs getting contaminated with the anthrax bacteria, and then people actually getting anthrax when they inject drugs. And people get
people still get your vaccine, please.
a way that Americans have gotten it over the years are from drums, so imported drums, so the hides that drums are made out of. Are in the embedded in the skin or the hides of those drums. And so Americans, when they import those drums and then play the drums, or maybe they import the hides and are making the drums in that process, then there have been Americans exposed to anthrax that way.
So the whole thing about washing your hands is important.
wasn't there a time, I'm just trying to think, between other countries we lived in, wasn't there a time in the States that some politicians received envelopes with anthrax?
Right. Well, 2001, right after 9/11, later in September, October, then there was a scientist. They are pretty sure, the FBI is pretty sure who the scientist was that did it. He wanted some more money for his research on anthrax, and he had access to a lab where he could purify the spores, and he sent... he sent the powder with anthrax in it in the mail to politicians, the newspaper, the National Enquirer in Florida, politicians in New York City and Washington, D.C., Tom Brokaw. And there were a number of people who became infected and died from anthrax sent through the mail that way.
So did they put him in jail, hopefully?
Well, it took them a very long time to figure out who it was. And at first they accused someone else, and who was a leading suspect for a very long time. And eventually he was able to clear his name and actually, I believe, got a successful lawsuit against the federal government for being wrongly accused. And they kept investigating. Finally, the evidence came together that it was this one scientist named Dr. Bruce Ivins. And but by the time that they pinpointed him, then he committed suicide. So... you know, some people still debate whether it was him or not. But
sounds like the Epstein thing.
Right. Maybe how did he commit suicide? He drank a potion with anthrax in it?
I can't recall what he did.
Yeah. So, wow.
Crazy. So nuts. When all these things are happening in the news, and you're also working in this field, were you writing this down going, oh, this would make a good story? I mean, where did the, like, I'm going to write a book up and an entire A to Z series? Oh, my gosh.
I know. I was just like,
I mean, it's like you've just committed to, like, how many letters in the alphabet again?
26 viruses.
Yes.
Right. Uh-huh. Well, and then I write about more of them in my short stories, too. So now, while I was actually doing public health, first for the CDC, then the New Mexico Health Department, and finally the New York Health Department, when you're doing it, you have no time to be thinking about creative writing. I mean, somebody could challenge it, pull it off, but for me, I couldn't. As you will see in Anthracis, the work demands on people who are epidemiologists for CDC or the state health departments, and particularly now with coronavirus, the work demands are intense. And so so that's one of the themes of the story is Maya is a 25-year-old. Can she have a personal life in addition to the demands of her, you know, wanting to make the world a better place, solve these diseases? Is it possible to have a personal life at the same time? And that's one thing that Maya will struggle with through this series. But yeah, when I was actually doing it, it felt like sometimes 24/7. And so creative writing at that point was not something that I was really thinking about. So it took retirement to really be able to have the time to focus.
Wow. And so, but creative writing, you know, that's something. Yeah. I mean, as a kid, did you have that? I mean, I think we all into poetry and writing short stories and essays. And
Yeah. Books have been my life for my entire life. I was fortunate to grow up in a family. My dad was a librarian. My mother was a teacher. And so, we're just surrounded by books. And in fact, the summer before I started veterinary school, I had a few rare months off. We were living in Utah, southern Utah, near the national parks, because my husband was mapping them for the U.S. Geological Survey.
Oh, wow.
And so I had a summer off. And so I would sit by the beautiful lakes there in southern Utah and hand wrote my first romance novel. And sent it off to someone who said, you know, that I really captured the beauty of southern Utah wonderfully. And if I ever wrote anything else, she'd like to see it. But then I started veterinary school and never had a moment again. So
yeah, that's a little busy.
Right. Yeah. So that was my last chance to do any creative writing until retirement. So,
you know, when you go into veterinary school and your whole thing is about the connection with these diseases and, you know, these microbial organisms and spores and animals to humans, you know, Ned's not pet sit as we travel the country now. And, you know, we've always had animals in our lives, all kinds
and plants
and all, you know, but we've seen so many people basically kiss their dogs and allow dogs to lick their faces, and they think it's cute. And I mean, even tongues touching, and Nancy and I will cringe. Yeah. I mean, we're really close to animals. I mean, I could put my hand in dog poop and I'm just like, whatever, you know, but if it's human, no, there's a difference. Animals, they can snore, they can fart, they can do anything. I don't care. Humans, no. But when I see that happen, both of us have this cringe. I don't know if it's from our lives in Africa, knowing about worms being transferred and things, but I always feel
all
like
sorts of things.
You can get something.
Yes,
I don't
you
care.
Can.
I just feel you can. What do you think?
Sure. And it's it is scary that one of the diseases that I investigated when I was with the New Mexico Health Department it's called Capnocytophaga canimorsis.
Oh my gosh, how do you remember this?
Jeez.
The second word canimorsis gives you a clue because it's canine for dog. Yeah. And basically this is an organism that's normal flora in the dog's mouth. So it's always there. It's not, you know, anything unusual. It doesn't make them sick or anything like that. But when they lick you, they can be sharing that organism, and most people won't have a problem with it. But some people, if you're immune suppressed or, have a problem with your spleen interestingly, some people who are alcoholics, when they're exposed to that organism from the dog's tongue, they can become severely ill and often die. And we had a case of it when I was with the Mexico Health Department from his dog. And So there are, I mean, basically we talk about one health. We're in a world where we've got humans, animals, and the environment, and we're all interacting all the time. And sometimes we forget, we focus just on ourselves, and we forget that we're living in with animals and the environment. So,
well, I know, I think a lot of people, because we've talked about this before with others, and their objection is that dogs have some antiseptic qualities in their saliva. I'm like, maybe for the dog, not for you. You know, I mean,
well, cats too. Cats do that lickety pig thing. I'm going to lick you clean. And I always
But we don't want to. We don't want to end up so afraid of animals that we avoid all contact.
No, we don't. We just.
It's to be reasonable and sensible,
right? And well, you know, you have hands and you pet them, right, and you talk to them, but you don't have to have a tongue discussion.
Have a tongue discussion with your pets. I had no idea where we're going to go here on this show today, but
now,
you know,
what are we doing?
I know, but it's true. Well. No, this is fascinating stuff. Now, you said flora. See, now that there's flora with flowers and fauna and flora, but then you said canine flora, and I just kind of went, oh, we're back to the yeasty, spory kind of. That's. I feel like the Dr. Swab is coming out, you know. So, but I think this is such a fun way to learn, you know.
Yeah. Go ahead. And that's one of the challenges of both the novel series and the short stories is how to share this fascinating information that a lot of people don't know about, particularly from inside the world of public health. Certainly now with coronavirus, people are learning more about public health and epidemiology, but they're still not learning about what it's like to be on the inside and really doing it. And so trying to share that information and that knowledge, which hasn't been done. There haven't been that many people who've actually done this work, who've written about it in a creative writing point of view. So to try to share it, but then make it entertaining, make it, you know, a fascinating mystery novel with characters that you care about. It's really challenging to get that balance where you want to share the knowledge, but you also want to have it be appealing for people to go on the ride with Maya Maguire through 26 novels and so that balance between the science and the emotion, which is the core of good creative writing, it's an important balance to get.
I think it's really important now because science, you know, I think science has been trampled on so much, and science is always changing, and because things change. You know, it does change. Geology changes. It's the whole thing. The world changes, right? And so you'll have one discovery that will trump out a previous discovery. And then some people go, well, scientists don't know anything. It's about keeping up. And there's always something new to learn. So I think that's what's so great about what you're doing is that balance of entertainment, but learning. But I feel like a really big need that scientists don't even get to speak on shows or, you know, main TV, mainstream media that much. And without, and people who put down science aren't in the world of science. So it's kind of really difficult.
I don't understand how you can put down science. I mean, okay, let's just put down history or let's put down any other of what we learn every day in school, and then we learn after as adults if you're interested in furthering your education. But to take science and now say that it's not true, maybe you need to start over and go back to school. Because, I mean, if there was no science, we wouldn't have any doctors. Right. How about that? Do you go to a doctor and say you don't believe in science? Do you go to a dentist and say you don't believe in science? Because
and maybe my work will help to humanize epidemiologists and scientists and people in public health to understand what they're trying to do. I recently restarted watching the TV series The West Wing, and you know, about life in the White House, and so that you learn what it's like to be a public servant working in the White House. And so I hadn't been thinking about it when I wrote the book, but I'm thinking about it now that my novel series is kind of the same way, that you're being brought to the inside of public health and epidemiology, particularly for these zoonotic diseases from animals, and learning about the challenges, the bureaucratic challenges, all the different agencies that you have to work with, the some of these disease outbreaks for the books that are in the Southwest happen on Native Nation lands, and you know, you need to respect their priorities, and so how do you juggle all the politics and the human interest versus the science,
and also as your main character Maya, for her being a young woman, is that also an issue in regards to getting through bureaucracy?
Sure, yeah. And she's actually a little younger than most of the EIS officers. Usually you get accepted into this EIS program from CDC after getting a doctoral degree. Either most of them are physicians. So Maya's already feeling a bit of an outsider because she's one of the few veterinarians accepted into this program. And so usually they're older, like in their, maybe in their late 20s, or early 30s, and she's only 25 because she's very smart, and her mother has kind of pushed her to skip some grades going through school. So she finished getting both her veterinary degree and her master's in public health by the time she was 25, which is pretty unusual.
Right.
And so she's struggling to keep up with others who are older. She's always felt a bit of an outsider growing up as a Chinese American. She grew up in first in Flagstaff, Arizona, and then in the Denver area. And so Asians are not, you know, heavily populated in that part of the country in the Southwest. And of course, growing up with an Anglo family, you know, parents who didn't look like her because she's adopted. So she's always felt a little bit of that outsider role pressure from, you know, being young, starting this job. She also had a really horrific car accident. She was on a bicycle when she was 5 years old and a truck ran her over.
Oh,
and
wow.
So she has residual physical trauma and mental trauma, anxiety from that incident when she was 5 years old. So she definitely struggles work hard and solve these outbreaks at the same time facing very human challenges.
Well, I think that's what people connect with in a book, is where you can identify with something, because we all have a struggle somewhere. But right. Also thinking now, you know, with what's been going on in our country, it's just the racism of,
right,
you know,
yes.
Of mm-hmm. Asian Americans, or just Asians in general, right? It
right.
seems that we have a lot of racism going, if you just don't look like me, that's that. And so I think that's also something really, really important, that so folks can identify, you know, right. and
connect. I do touch on that a little bit about Maya's feelings of being an immigrant and some of the initial anthrax cases and anthracis occur along the Arizona-Mexico border and are related to immigration. And so Maya identifies with the cases that are occurring in that region because of her own immigrant background. So,
I mean, in this country, unless you're Native American, you are, or your family at some point was an immigrant,
or you know, were brought here against your will.
Well, yeah. So I mean, it's really kind of a waste of time. All this. Well, it doesn't make any sense, really. You know, it's irrational to me that you're going to worry about somebody's background when your own background, like if we all had to go back to where our great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents or grandparents came from, probably some of us would be in Europe. Some of us would be in England, some would be in Germany, some would be in Switzerland. Yeah,
But unfortunately, this issue of the other, of us, you know, us versus them.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I think from my knowledge of animals, it's kind of hardwired into us as animals. Mm-hmm. You know, we're human animals. And you see that in animal populations as well. It's a us versus them. It's an innate thing for protection.
Survival,
For survival, right. And so we are biologically wired to, you know, gather around us those who are similar to us and be scared of those who are different. But of course, as humans, we have higher level functioning. We should be able to try to, you know, push past that at this stage in our cultural development. But I do try to have a little understanding that there is a biological basis for this othering that happens.
Yeah, I think so. I have another weird question. I don't know if it's weird, but you're looking at what's going on also in this country in regards to agriculture and monocrops, right? And how cattle are getting fed, and is that because we're looking at even what's happening with our topsoil, right? And so the environment is being changed, and it's part of why we have the global warming. And I did say it, global warming issues going on. But with that, so if the food is changing for animals, not just livestock, but even for wildlife, right? Well, that also bring in more of these organisms and give them an opportunity to hatch or come to life before these epidemics.
Sure. Well, certainly food is an important component. In my second book, Borrelia, which I'm finishing the editing and hope to have it published in the spring. Borrelia may be somewhat familiar name to some people, because the Lyme disease organism is a Borrelia. But there's a lot of other Borrelia that people are not aware of at all that causes diseases. And in Borrelia, Maya actually ends up going overseas and working on a disease called relapsing fever that's from different kinds of Borrelia. And she investigates some cases in Portugal that are related to pig farming. So the pigs, how they're housed in Portugal, in rural Portugal, the ticks like to live in the huts that the pigs sleep in at night. And then for the humans working with those pigs, then they can be bitten by those ticks. Mm-hmm. And get this disease, this Borrelia called relapsing fever. So agriculture, and of course, those who are poorer, one of the things that's happening to some of the characters in Borrelia are, as the price of living is going up in Lisbon, and people can't afford to live there anymore, the elderly who are poor end up going back and actually living with their pigs on the pig farms. And so their living conditions are not great. And so it makes it easy for them to be bitten by these ticks and get Borrelia. So the poverty that's going with gentrification and the increased cost of everything is leading more and more people in regards to their lives and how they live and the agriculture to have more contact with these diseases. And then, of course, climate change, global warming is really impacting this. One of the biggest impacts of climate change is believed to be with people losing their crops. Already, a lot of the immigrants coming across the border from Mexico and countries further south are because of climate change in Central America, ruining their livelihoods and, you know, their ways to make living in their crops and everything. And so they're coming north for a better life. So,
I think, well, there's a lot of it that they're saying, even from the islands and from Alaska, these little smaller areas, there is a definite, I mean, it's evacuations are going to be happening everywhere, which means immigration everywhere. And at some point we're going to have to get along on that. So the food part can happen. So can autoimmune disease be linked to spores and organisms and these microbials? Because the autoimmune thing is weird, man. It's weird what's going on with that.
That's a fascinating subject that people, you know, we don't know everything about. But this whole issue we were talking about of animal contact, of, you know, being afraid of it, perhaps because of the organisms that we could get from them. But the other extreme is if we're too isolated, then our immune systems have not built up familiarity with these germs. And so there's a predominant theory now that if you're too isolated from animal organisms in the soil and from other little kids in daycare or whatever, then you're more susceptible to these organisms because your immune system has not seen them before. And it might be better to be exposed to some of these things when you're young and your immune system can grow and adapt to them. So it's all a balance of the environment, of animals and humans. That's the best way to go.
You know, that so reminds me of my grandmother. She's a little 4'9" British lady. She was like, you can go out and play in the sunshine for 2 hours. And yes, you can put your hands in the dirt, but you will don't put your hands on your face, and you will wash your hands when you come inside. When it was damp or raining out, she's like, no, you'll get sick. That was it with her. So it was like, you got your sunshine time only. And then you had to, that's when you could sit inside and read a book. That's how she sort of partially raised us. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because she had that thing about you don't play in the damp, mm-hmm. and rain. You don't play outside.
Yeah, and I don't know about, where that not, might have come from. There's a fascinating organism called Balis ascaris procyonis, which is a raccoon roundworm. And one of my short stories, on the website is about this organism. So it's a worm in raccoons, and they basically, you know, spread it through their feces into the soil. And so that's the main thing why they say you should cover up kids' sandboxes, is because if raccoons are using the sandbox as a toilet, this organism can get into the little kids, because little kids are not washing their hands before putting their hands in their mouth. And infections with that organism are almost invariably fatal. They cause such bad breathing. And so
from a poor little raccoon.
Yeah,
from do it.
And the raccoon doesn't get sick from it or anything. So
So it's a roundworm.
So don't kiss a raccoon either.
Wow. Well, but that's sad, because also then people get really scared and then go out and start shooting all the raccoons. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's why we want to have that balance. And I think that's important to understand. We need them too. Right. They're that ecosystem, that web of life. And that's something I think is so important about, even right now we're watching with climate change and also in lack of coexistence and how we've taken over so much of their land. And we have to coexist, that it can't be, you see a snake, kill it. Because part of why we have climate change, which I think is just rarely discussed, is that we've upset the balance, the actual ecosystem web of life. That, you know, even a tiny spider or a little fish that you think, who cares if that goes extinct? What did that do for me? Well, it actually changes the entire structure.
It shifts everything. But
it is like a house of cards.
Right? Yeah. And you keep shifting the structure, it's going to collapse. And then some of those tiny, especially insects that we don't know very much about, a lot of us, you wipe out entire populations of an insect for the sake of a crop, you might be taking away the one insect that could save your life later. You don't know, because we haven't had the opportunity to study every single insect from the standpoint of what benefits it can bring.
Right. And eliminating animals because we're afraid of the diseases that they carry is almost never effective, because the wildlife are just out there everywhere, and you may reduce a population in one spot, but then it'll come back and fill in. So it's rarely effective. And so part of the disease control that we did, for instance, in when I was with both New Mexico and New York health departments dealing with diseases like plague, particularly in New Mexico, or West Nile virus in New York.
Oh, wow.
And rabies in New York is another big disease on the East Coast from the raccoons.
Wow.
You know, actually eliminating those animals doesn't work. You know, the organism is around in other animals. And so sometimes in a really bad outbreak that's very local, removing a few animals that are infected from that can reduce the outbreak at that one point. But most of the time we have to use other methods. For instance, plague in the Southwest, it's not eliminating the ground squirrels and the prairie dogs that have it. That doesn't work. It's you know, being careful with your wood piles where those rodents might like to live, using flea control, other things like that are the ways to reduce the risk of plague, not eliminating all the animals that have it. So
because where did they get it? You know, that's not the source. They just carry it.
So then with climate change, and just even going back to your first book, Anthracis, or Anthrax, Anthracis, that's a cool name though. With, you know, it goes from Texas and then all of a sudden it's popping up in Arizona. Do you think with climate change that these organisms or microbials can be nomadic, kind of like people move because of water sources? So they'll start to, it's like the migration of spores.
Well, these diseases are spread by either animals themselves or sometimes by vectors like mosquitoes or ticks or fleas. And so as climate change makes the environment more compatible for either these animals or these vectors, then we will see increased risk. And so that's believed to be part of what's going on with Lyme disease as it spread further and further north. Lyme disease wasn't a big problem in New England a number of years ago, and then it kept spreading north as it got warmer in New England. And so the environments are more conducive for the ticks, the deer, and the mice that host the ticks. And so you see Lyme disease moving north. And so a number of these diseases, there is worry with warming and with relocation. For instance, rabies from the raccoons in the East Coast. If you were at a higher altitude, you were kind of more protected because the raccoons didn't like to live at the higher altitude. But now with warming, the raccoons are living at higher elevations. And so you have more increased risk of coming across a rabid raccoon. So for all of these diseases, depending on the complexity of its life cycle, there can be increased risk with climate change and global warming. So.
Wow. Amazing. This is fascinating. I want to read Anamnesis. I want to read them all. I'm just going to be curious of like the alphabet too. That's a whole other, that's neat. I think it's fascinating. Scary. So I want to know, is your kitchen like totally bleached out? Like
No. You know, the thing about, you know, again, about if you use too many antibiotics, you build up antibiotic resistance.
Yeah.
So again, everything has to be in balance. So,
okay. I was just going to say, if you go to dinner at Millie's house, you got to wash your hands 10 times first. You know,
the bad thing about going to dinner with me is that I can tell you all the different ways that you can get sick from the different
Yeah, well, you know, it's like, you know, whenever time a fly lands on food and people just shoot it off, all I can think of is that fly threw up on your cantaloupe.
Oh, stop it.
But I have to tell you that at least in the novel, so that the short stories which people can read now on the website are spooky and short and so, you know, just to warn you, they are really spooky mysteries. The novels, because they're longer, can be more complex. And I promise that every novel will end with what we call in romance literature, happy for now, HFN, happy for now. So there will, each novel will have a happy for now, but then it'll also have a little bit of spooky foreboding to the next novel. So, but there are warm, humorous parts of the novels too. It isn't all just scary.
You have to have the balance, like you say. It's all about balance.
Yeah.
Right. And there's romantic suspense, and I call Anthrace as kind of a hybrid between a microbial mystery, romantic suspense, and women's fiction, because we're learning about Maya's journey as a person and her development. So
awesome. Well, Millie, thank you so much for joining us. This is so fascinating.
Yeah, it's fun.
I'm all geeked out now. I'm going to go look at a Petri dish online.
Well, I would like to have the virus alphabet.
Yeah, I do.
I want to know the 26.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I haven't released that yet, just in case I get to a later number and later alphabet letter and change my mind.
But, because we could have a new disease. You know, right. We could have a new epidemic. Right. So, you know, got it. But I like that you got the Zika. Nancy and I always go around and go, you got the Zika.
You got the Zika.
I don't know why we do that. But anyway.
Because you got the Zika.
Who's got the Zika?
You got the Zika.
So everyone, again, the website is drmayamaguire.com. That's DrMayamaguire. Just, you know, proving I can spell. I want to thank you all for joining us. And also keep up with the Tucson Sisters in Crime. Go to TucsonSistersInCrime.org. And also, of course, keep up with us at BigBlendRadio.com. We air Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a blast.
Thank you.
Yeah. Very interesting.